From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 463, Cloud Security with guest Oren Thomas. Recorded Tuesday, February 16th, 2016. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Oren Thomas, who's an MVP, a Microsoft RD, and a Microsoft Certified Trainer, and also has a string of Microsoft certifications, including MCSE and MCITP. You can go crazy with this alphabet soup. He's written more than 36 books for Microsoft Press on topics including Windows Server, Client, Azure, System Center, Exchange Server, Security, and SQL Server. He's an author of Pluralsight and a contributing editor to Windows IT Pro. He's been working in IT since the early 1990s, regularly speaks at conferences in Australia and around the world. Oren founded and runs the Melbourne System Center Security and Infrastructure Group and is a candidate in the Doctor of Information Technology program at Charles Stewart University. And follow him at Oren Thomas, all one word, and Thomas spelt the correct way, T-H-O-M-A-S. Greetings, sir. Almost a PhD? Are you actually like working on a thesis?
Yeah, well, my thesis is actually cloud security. So what I'm looking at is I'm looking at the guidelines that are used by different organizations, mostly like the federal guidelines, to assess cloud security. Because obviously, if someone's going to go and push certain workloads in the cloud, they've sort of got to meet certain government standards or compliance requirements. So what I'm doing is I'm doing a deep investigation, and it's a doctorate rather than a PhD. And
okay. What would be the difference? I always thought a doctorate was a PhD.
No, so there is a slight odd difference in that, and I actually was undertaking a PhD in the 90s, so I understand this from both sides. A PhD is usually a little bit longer, maybe 20,000 words longer.
Right.
And the Doctorate of Information Technology does have a short amount of coursework components. So I could have gone into either the Doctorate of Information Technology or a PhD in computer science. And you both are accredited with the title. So you still get to call yourself doctor,
right,
independent of each one. But yeah, what happened?
Not the kind of doctor that can do anybody any good, but a doctor.
Well, the original translation of doctor from Latin means teacher. So right. The interesting story around the title doctor is that the medicos actually took it from the people who had done original research sometime in the sort of 18th, 19th century. So when people go, oh, you're not a real doctor, it's sort of like,
yeah, it's, well, the opposite actually, is true. They're not real doctors.
Yes, because that's the only way that you can get the title without actually producing original research.
Right.
So it is. It's one of those weird things that people go, oh, no, that's not a real doctor. And it's, well, actually go and look what doctor means. Doctor means teacher. It doesn't mean healer.
And I do appreciate that you are working on a significant piece of like core contribution to the science of really getting your head around cloud security. That's important stuff.
Well, it's interesting. It's very interesting because when you look at any sort of compliance regulation, what you find is it's often written by lawyers and politicians rather than technologists. And so what happens when organizations are going to sort of try and attempt to meet their compliance requirements, or you've got, for example, Google, Amazon, or Microsoft sort of saying, how do we meet this set of standards? There is this disconnect between the people who have sort of put this legalese in an attempt to describe technology that existed at the time, but the technology is moving so quickly.
Sure.
So part of what my research is how do you come up with a set of reasonable compliance guidelines around security given the rapid movement in the field, and sort of looking at the relevance, you know, of this legislation. And to a certain extent, it's like, it's great for cloud providers to go and put this certification on their thing and say, hey, we meet, you know, this particular information processing standard. But a lot of people don't look beyond that. They don't say, well, what does that actually mean? And so my research is basically, okay, I'm actually going to go in and really look at what does this mean, and you know, obviously someone who's making that assessment understands, but your general consumer of cloud services doesn't.
No, they want to see a green logo or something that says, don't worry, everything's fine.
Exactly. And if we think about, I was watching the film The Big Short recently, which was talking about sort of how governments were, government agencies were certifying particular financial instruments. And no one understood what they were doing.
Right.
And so all of these financial instruments were certified as being rated as reliable when in fact they were completely unreliable and we had a financial crash because of it.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting to wonder whether or not, and I suspect I know the answer, whether or not these certifications are to an extent somewhat meaningless. And so my hope is that, you know, I'm in an odd position. I know that generally, and this is one of the reasons I stopped. I was doing a PhD in philosophy of science, and then I started writing books for Microsoft. And my supervisor sort of sat me down one day and said, look, your research is important. I was doing a PhD on legal standards for scientific evidence admissibility. And he said, look, what you're doing is really important, but let's be honest here. Unless you're lucky, your PhD thesis is probably not going to be read by more than 20 people. You're writing a book for Microsoft that might be read by 50 to 100,000 people, which is a more fulfilling life. And I went, well, probably writing the books for Microsoft
sure.
because, you know, they actually have an impact. And it was only sort of 15 years later, what happened was that Charles Sturt University I was talking to someone from there, and they've only recently this program, the Doctorate of Information Technologies, only been around about 5 years. And for them, it was sort of a get to get someone who was, you know, known in the field and had written a lot of books and was obviously a serious IT professional to go and then go and take a doctorate from this university.
Right.
Because then they could turn around and say, well, look, so and so's got one. There is meaning to this. It's not just a meaningless credential. And
yeah.
I've got a reason because when you're writing, one of the weird things about technical writing is that you're often rushing to just explain what something does, but you don't necessarily get to get under it and pick it apart. And that's one of the things that you get to do in academic.
This is the nature of technology books, right? I mean, technology books are trying to drop the day the product drops. And so you work
exactly.
in betas and, you know, constantly have to revise. You're basically writing the manual. It should have come with the product in the first place. How can you possibly assess how a product should be used when it was still being made?
Exactly. So there's a lot of compromises that you make in the process of writing a book just to get it out on time. And also that, a good example is one of my favorite books that I've written, and it wasn't a great seller, because the certification stuff sells really well. But, years ago, someone came to me and said, what we'd like you to do is we'd like you to write an expert's book on Server 2008 R2, which
right.
had been out by that time for about 2 years. And they said, you know, obviously you've got more experience with it than when you've written other 2008 books. We'd like something like that. So I wrote an insider's guide to Windows Server 2008 R2. And everybody who read it who was an expert went, oh my gosh, I have picked up so much that I didn't know, even though I've been using this operating system for years.
Huh.
The problem is the market for that sort of book is very small because most people look at a book and they go, oh, you know, mastering, and I'm not picking on Mark Manassi here. I'm just saying when Mark writes Mastering Windows Server 2016, he's aiming at people who might not necessarily be experienced server administrators simply because the bulk of the audience is that introductory reader.
Yeah. And then even if they're not, it's like, let's just start with the foundational stuff, right? I mean, I think it always the foundational stuff outsells the expert stuff every time.
Absolutely. And that's what happened with this book was that ultimately, it was an excellent book. If you were an intermediate to an advanced systems administrator,
right.
It was just that the audience is for people who are brand new to it. And I get people occasionally pinging me on Twitter saying, are you going to write more of these? And I said, well, it didn't sell. But
yeah, there's no money in it.
Yeah, exactly.
And you still have to feed the family.
Yes. And ultimately, you get to the point where it's like, well, I could write this as a passion project, but why would I do that now? And that's to an extent what my doctorate is. My doctorate is more a passion project
right.
because at least at the end of that, it's not going to pay me any extra money. It's not going to change anything except for, you know, when I get on the airplane, they say, well, Dr. Thomas will lead you to your seat.
That and $5 will get you a latte.
Exactly, because having worked in a university very early on in my career, I know that academic titles mean absolutely nothing. But it's one of those things that because I get to investigate a subject over a course of years and really get into it, it provides me with a different sort of intellectual stimulation.
It's got to be deeply rewarding, too, to be personally to finish your thinking around such an important subject like cloud security.
Well, that's my hope, and I believe it will be, and that's why I'm willing to go and spend that time on doing something that's, you know, obviously not bringing in dollars. I could be wasting it riding a jet ski around the Gold Coast.
Who would do that? Nobody would do that.
No one would do that.
And of course, we're obliquely referring to our mutual friend, Troy Hunt. What is it with Australians and security exactly?
We were founded as a prison colony. Maybe that's got something to do with it.
Oh, you're going
to
go there, are you?
Oh, why not? It's like someone, when people go talk about a Bill of Rights in Australia, it's like, why didn't you have a Bill of Rights? And I was like, we were a prison colony. You know, they probably weren't too hot on giving us a whole lot of rights at the time. There's a whole lot of things that, you know, when you found a nation for freedom, like our friends to your south, you get a whole lot of intellectual baggage that comes along with it, whereas ours was like, yeah, you're stuck in a jail. Although I saw an English comedian many years ago who came out and he said, I've come out to Australia and I think my ancestors are idiots. Let me talk you through my thinking. We've got England where it's cloudy, it's dark, and it rains all the time. And they thought it was a really good idea to punish people by sending them to a place where it was sunny all the time. There were great beaches, great food, wonderful weather. Who is thinking this out?
He's not wrong, although it's such a long way away.
It is. You get on a plane, and it's one of those things where you get on the plane and you think, unless you go to New Zealand, and New Zealand is still, you know, 2.5 hours away from where I am. But you get on the plane and you look at that little thing, like how many hours you've got to go. Oh, you've got 14 hours to go to get to Los Angeles, or you've got 9 hours to go to get to Singapore, and Singapore's close.
I remember, and people make that mistake all the time. I've done that Singapore-Sydney flight, and it's 8-9 hours. And you started at the equator. It's like, it turns out the Southern Hemisphere is as big as the Northern Hemisphere. Who knew?
Yes, you're flying to Singapore in the first 4 or 5 hours, you're still flying over Australia.
Yeah,
so land. It's a very long way. But I think also I do wonder, maybe that's why there is such an interest in security from Australians, is simply that maybe that there's something permeating the culture about, we were a jail once.
I'm a jailer, not the jailed. Is that what that is?
I don't know. I think but the weird thing is that we naturally here seem to have more sympathy for the convicts. And, you know, one of the great national heroes is Ned Kelly, who was one of the bushrangers. And he wasn't certainly a Robin Hood sort of a figure, because he didn't give to the poor. He just robbed from the rich. But he made he wrote a very famous letter where he was railing against the sort of the colonial powers. And that we still haven't declared independence from England, and, you know, it's a long way down the track. But the bushrangers and the convicts are not – they're sort of romanticized here, as opposed to being something that was embarrassed. I was very surprised to find, when I looked into history, that for many years convicts were sent to North America. And in fact, one of the reasons that Australia was settled was that after the American Revolution, the United Kingdom had nowhere to send its convicts. So they sort of went back and said, well, Captain Cook found this place, you know, in 1770. Perhaps we should go and colonize that, because we've got all these prisoners we've got to get rid of. And it looks like the French might be going there as well. So we killed two birds with one stone.
Nice. All right, we should talk a little bit about cloud security here.
Yep.
Crazy Australians. Let me pay the bills first, and then I want to dive right into some of the broader thinking here, because Run As Radio is brought to you by UpGuard, formerly known as ScriptRock. UpGuard pinpoints configuration drift wherever it occurs within your environment, no matter the platform, and alerts you to unexpected changes happening on any machine. Vulnerability scanning and PowerShell DSC support come standard, and the latest iteration of UpGuard is the only platform that gives you the Cybersecurity Threat Assessment Report, a FICO-like score for your cyber risk. Try it for free at upguard.com/runasradio. So if I'm going to work on a set of standards around security, I got to get away from product-specific things. Like, it's got to be broader reach than that to tolerate the rapid change that's going on in the cloud.
Correct.
So what does that look like? What do we talk about?
Well, you've got to look at a range of things. For example, when they're talking about encryption standards, like data being encrypted, they may suggest a particular algorithm, and that's fine because that's a vendor agnostic to a certain extent. Sure. Everybody's sort of got their own way of sort of dealing with that. But there's a whole lot of, I mean, just conceptualizing what are the questions around cloud security. One of the challenges, certainly when you talk to people about cloud security, there's a wonderful story I heard about an organization where they had contracted out someone moving their on-prem to the cloud. Mm-hmm. And they'd contracted it out. So they had given this contractor, basically with cloud, any cloud subscription, you've got almost a root account, which is usually tied to something like a Hotmail account or a Gmail account. Yep. And someone logs in with that. And they do whatever they set up the infrastructure. Anyway, so what happened was that this guy went and migrated this organization's resources to the cloud and he invoiced them. And they didn't pay the invoice on time. And he said, look, you got to pay me. And they're like, yeah, we'll get there. And they're using, we'll get around to it. Yeah. And he said, well, look, if you don't pay me by date X, I'm going to go and delete everything. And they said, and they didn't get around to paying him. And that's the difference between, you know, cloud and on-prem security. A hacker gets into your on-prem environment and they might be able to trash everything, but you can probably go to your backup tapes, which is stored off-site, and restore your infrastructure because they can destroy the software, but unless they're exceptionally good, they probably can't destroy the hardware. Yeah. With cloud, someone gets access to that one account. They can go and delete your entire infrastructure.
Sure. And if you haven't made any other backups, you really are kind of hooped.
Yeah. And all of the cloud providers are offering this sort of backup within the cloud where it's backing up from one part of their cloud to another.
It's still that's part of that great. Same account.
Exactly. So that's one of those interesting things about cloud security and about how would you write a standard around that? Because a lot of the assumptions that people have, they don't even sit there. Security is often one of those barn door sort of a situations. Yeah. Where someone has done something and then people sit there and think, how do we protect against that happening again?
Right.
I find it fascinating, especially with the sophistication through which people will go through, for example, account hijacking. To get access, because you only need to get access to that one account. So my recommendation to people is basically that they have a root account and then they never use it. They make the two-factor authentication. But what generally happens and what we know happens in a lot of environments is that someone sets up a test cloud account and then they start moving resources into that account.
Yeah.
And that root account might still be their personal Hotmail account. And then that person's going to go and leave the organization and they're like, oh, our entire organization's cloud infrastructure is still using, you know, Joe's Hotmail account as the root account.
Because that was the test, right? I mean, I still have my beta name for Skype because I was on that beta and I just never moved the account.
Exactly. And one of the true rules of IT is that things that were only ever meant to be in development end up in production for decades.
Without a doubt. But I know we've talked about this a bunch of times on the show. This granularization of administrative privileges, I think, is hugely important. Like, not only would I like that root account to never be used, you know, and to have as maximum security and so forth on it, I don't think I want it to have any rights except to create other accounts. So
exactly. And that's something that one of the other things that you see with the cloud providers, and that's something that, you know, I'll be looking at with my thesis work. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that you see with the providers is that very much the cloud providers are it's important to understand that when the cloud providers have gone out and built AWS or they've gone out and built Azure, they didn't build it with this grand plan in mind.
Right.
What they're doing is that they're getting built by accretion. So they're bolting stuff on as it goes along. So this beautiful design where you would design, you know, if you were going to go back and redesign the installation process for Windows Server, the first thing you would have is you would have a setup account. And the job of that setup account right at the end would be to delegate rights to a bunch of separate accounts that are going to be used for everything else. But we still have that administrator account, and that's your God mode account. It's used for everything. So if you were designing cloud from the ground up, you would go and do that. But the reality is that cloud hasn't been, it's accreted that Microsoft is rushing so quickly to compete with Amazon, and Amazon's rushing so quickly to compete with Microsoft that they're bringing out new features, but there's not necessarily a holistic design choice around security. So security is there in components, but it's not a holistic approach to security. It's more like, okay, we're doing this now. Like a new feature that's just come out is, Azure Key Vault. And with Azure Key Vault, what you can do now is you can BitLocker encrypt VMs that are running in the cloud. Now, if you were thinking about designing Azure from the ground up, you would have had BitLocker encrypted IaaS VMs from the get-go.
Sure.
Because your great fear as someone who's running a workload in the cloud is that someone does a sort of a Mission Impossible break into a data center. They find a particular rack. They just pull out the storage, and then they've got the virtual machines that are running on that rack. In fact, all of the, everything's PaaS is obviously running on top of pre-built virtual machines. And all of that data is sitting there in an unencrypted form. And of course, if you can get access to the machines, you get access to everything. And we keep getting told by the cloud providers, oh, we've got all of these standards around physical security. But we also know that the most expensive thing in a data center is, of course, the people that are in there.
Right.
And the aim of all of these cloud providers is to make lights out data centers. You know, they're talking about, we saw the other week where Microsoft's talking about chucking them over into the water.
Yeah. Well, they did it. They built a test one and put it in the water, which I think is very cool.
That's great until someone comes along in 10 years' time with a submarine and picks up your data center and wanders off with it.
And steals it.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's a lot. It's a lot harder to go and guard a tank that's sitting. You know, what are they doing? Are they going to put sharks there with laser beams or something like that? That'd be a great cloud security standard.
Very interesting. I mean, yeah, it would be interesting to see how do you provide physical security for something under the water.
And we have to take to a certain extent their assurances about the physical security standards that exist around these facilities. And we're hoping that, you know, that they are wonderfully and competently guarded.
Well, and even if they're not, that you don't have any dependency on any given data store anyway. So somebody steals that thing. Presumably there's copies elsewhere that are still running, so you won't be affected. And then presumably you have enough encryption on it that it's not going to be worth cracking it.
One would hope. But so again, this coming back to what my research is. My research in part is just for me to gain an understanding of what on earth do these standards mean?
Right.
Because, you get a Baghdad Bob almost approach from each cloud vendor where they swear black and blue that they're secure. But you only have to watch Troy Hunt's interactions with people that have gone through organizations that have gone through data breaches. They always claim they're secure until their stuff ends up on Pastebin.
Well, Ashley Madison still says they're secure. Check the homepage.
Exactly. So, of course, cloud providers are going to say this. So what chance is there for an independent systems administrator to assess the security? If security is their main thing, how do they make a comparison between Amazon, Google, and Microsoft in terms of cloud providers? And that was one of the other reasons that I sort of got into this. I thought, you know, how would you make that choice?
Yeah,
how would you assess that? And the reality is that most people have no idea what tools to pick up to solve that problem.
To actually make an assessment like that.
Yes. And, you know, the best that they can do is they can delegate it to this set of standards that they don't understand. So,
well, I think there's another side of this, which is so much security is sort of apocryphal or completely episodic, right? It's just like, oh, I know a guy who, and well, what happens when? And it's like only one breach and all of this is garbage.
Like, yes.
This idea, you know, did a show a while ago with Paula Janowski, you know, talking about other great security people, who's a pen tester. She says, you know what? You could almost always get in. It's what happens next. And nobody's willing to have a conversation about security that isn't absolute. They will never get in. Not yes. actually being able to tolerate. We can detect that we've been breached. We minimize harm. We clean up the mess.
Yes. So I find that fascinating. And that's one of the things I thought, here's an opportunity for me to go and play around and sort of spend some intellectual time just going in and looking at this. And, you know, hopefully there's someone who's got answers. I'm assuming there is. I'm assuming that there's people that know this. It's just that generally people don't ask these questions just because they don't have the time to do it. I've got the time. Well, I don't have the time, but I'll find the time
right.
and the impetus, because at the end I get sort of a reward where at worst I end up walk out of this with one, a credential, and two, a much better understanding of all of the bits and pieces that go into this, which you don't usually get when you're building courseware or you're building books to right. just explain it. Because when you're explaining something, you're very much, this is how it works. What you're not doing is you're not getting underneath it and going, this is why it works that way. Right. And these are the decisions that were made to make it work this way.
And it's sort of the right things to do from here. Right. I mean, I love the idea of Azure Key Vault. I just see how you could screw up using this thing pretty badly.
Yes. And at the moment, because it's beta, there's a whole lot of mucking around you've got to do to get it working.
Right.
And so often with IT security and IT practice, we are so focused on, can we get it to work? We don't necessarily focus on, have we got this working in a secure way? And right. that's what we see with developer security, is the goal is very much, we just want the thing to fly. We don't really worry about whether or not it's going to fly for the next 100 years, sort of a thing. We're so pressured to just get to the goal of working that we're not necessarily pressured to get to the goal of working in a secure manner. And right. hopefully that's something that we get. I know Microsoft changed their approach with the SDL when they said basically we need to sort of rewrite Vista from scratch. But we also know, just pragmatically, because we throw updates at things every month, that obviously it's not entirely built for, you know, it's built as secure as humanly possible. But obviously there's problems that are being dealt with and patched on a regular basis where, you know, we're spackling things
sure.
once they're in production because yes. we've got to hit those release dates.
Well, and you can't really take things down and so forth. You know, it occurs to me that we have yet to have, knock on wood, a really significant data breach from a major technology company, a Microsoft or a Google or an Amazon or anything like that. I wonder if we're just lucky so far.
It could be that we're lucky, and it could be we simply don't know about it. Just because one of the things about any data breach is that you only find out about it if people blab.
Right.
So, for example, with Troy, he only gets stuff into Have I Been Pwned if someone hands him over breach data.
Yeah, once it's public.
And, yeah. Which is public. If he doesn't buy it, he doesn't know what's on the market. I don't think Troy goes and is, as far as I know, I don't think Troy's hanging around the darknet looking for stuff. But it's sort of like, you know, Rumsfeld said, we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
So it would be, we know that people are attacking these services all of the time. We know that the public statement is, and I have no reason to doubt the honesty of this, that no one's got in. But this, given how good and given that we've got state actors that are attacking this sort of thing. We've got, you know, there's a book by a guy named Shane Harris called At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex, which is, if I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's one I absolutely recommend, where he just talks the extent to which the American intelligence IT infrastructure has been compromised by other state actors around the world. And My thought is that if people like that are running at this level, that, you know, the US military and the US intelligence services are getting compromised, there is no reason not to assume that one of the public cloud providers might not be compromised as well, at least at, you know, this state actor level. And there's a thing that Jeffrey Snover says. He says that if state actors are doing it today, script kiddies are doing it in 5 years' time.
Sure.
So it's one of those sort of existential questions as to whether or not you can actually secure something. And my increasing sort of philosophical belief is that probably not. It's got to be about damage mitigation. It's about how do you stop, you know, as Paula said to you, how do you stop someone once they're in? And we're seeing that there's an approach from Microsoft in terms of where Jeffrey Snover's talking about just enough administration and just in time administration, where he's saying, look, when you've got someone who's assume a breach and then mitigate as much as you can. So assume, you know, that doesn't mean let the castle walls down. Put the castle walls up, but build the inside of the castles, assuming that you've got to not only got the castle walls, but you're going to be defending inside the castle as well.
A gate within a gate,
sort of turtles all the way down sort of a thing. So, again, that's something I'm just investigating, partly for my own edification, partly because it'll get me an academic credential.
I think I want to read this thing, Oren. Like, this is this sort of taking the time to actually think through this whole process and talk about this granularly like this. It's very exciting to me. Maybe I'm the only one. I don't know. We'll see.
Well,
what the
it's
say.
Enough that it's interesting to everybody I've talked to goes, that's interesting. We'd like to read. And I go, well, that's good. Obviously, I like people reading my stuff, but it's not, it is. It's going to be more a journey of what I can teach myself, because I think that we are so reactive in, especially when we're talking about and we're learning things, we're so reactive and we're not very structured. We almost have a just-in-time approach to learning. We need to understand how this works. We will learn so that we can accomplish this. And then we move on to the other thing. And the difference with academic learning is academic learning is being far more holistic about your approach to the topic, where you're looking at things that you might not need to know to solve a problem, but you're trying to understand what's going on. So my hope is that by doing this work, you know, even though I've written more than three dozen books for Microsoft on Microsoft technologies, I think that there's another level I can get to in terms of my own intellectual maturity about understanding these topics, perhaps by just, you know, wandering off doing this research. You know, I'm keeping writing books while I'm doing it, but that I'll write better books simply because of the what I'll learn by going through this process.
Right. And maybe there's a revelation here, the sort of key things. I'm a big believer in this granularization of administrative privilege, of, you know, escalate slowly and de-escalate quickly, and the security in depth. I think it's all part and parcel of it, but I'm sure there's more, and I'm suspecting you're going to find it for us.
Well, we'll say it's one of the things about research is you don't necessarily start off assuming what you're going to find.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And that's why it's research. It's not like I've got this problem to solve. I know where my endpoint is.
Yeah. Oren, thank you so much for talking to me. That was very, very fun, and I'm looking forward to seeing the results.
Cool, thanks.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.